Hello. Now we are in the virtual instruction mode, which for our purposes can be defined as there is no longer any music. Before I begin, I'd like to spend a moment on the question of how to listen to recorded classes. One of the difficulties with the video conferencing Zoom approach being followed by your other teachers is that the process of synchronizing in a virtual class is not necessarily ideal for learning. Primates are visual animals, mostly working in the daytime. We believe what we see, and we imagine what we hear, a subject we have discussed in other contexts before. In a classroom where we see other people paying attention, our attention systems come into a kind of temporary synchronization. A self-aware teacher might use music, for example, as a system for accommodating different people to a common rhythm and a similar sequence of harmonics as part of the process of causing everybody's attention systems to stabilize. When we are by ourselves listening to something, however, our minds work, indeed our brains work, in a different way. The need to imagine what we hear, which is the primate animal's response to the condition of darkness and the need to understand threats and other events in the dark, the imagination of what we hear causes our minds to work differently when we are listening to speech without the cueing presence of others about how and in what cadence to pay attention. Our minds work hard, maybe harder, the imagination certainly does, but we work a little differently, and the cycling over time is different. When you're listening to a class on your own, it's a good idea, I think, to pause from time to time and to allow a period of mental consolidation to occur. This is also a good idea in a live class, where once again it might be good to take an intermission in the conversation, perhaps also to take an opportunity to reset and resynchronize people's attention systems. One might do that again with music or some other form of little break in the class. In a long seminar as an undergraduate, I saw how a short period of socialization and having some coffee and bread and cheese might actually change the nature of the conversation in the second half of the seminar, a process that I've worked with in my own teaching for a third of a century since. So if you take a momentary break from time to time, once or twice in the course of listening to a recorded class, and use your mind in another way, read notes or make drawings or in some other way reuse the knowledge or the ideas which have come to you in the course of the listening, I think you'll find that it works better than the end-to-end listening or watching a recorded class. With that in mind, then, let's ask about the reading before us, Putnam's Way We Are, and to try and put it at this moment before spring vacation in what is usually a moment of consolidation in the flow of a course. Usually about this time we are reaching a midpoint where, again, it's useful to begin to think back and consider what we have accomplished, what new ideas have come to us, what we thought about them, how we responded to them. A moment of consolidation that allows the second portion of the course after the mid-semester break, to be rebuilt in a way based upon our own resetting of our expectations and our understandings of what we're doing in the course. For the teacher, even if the schedule is very clear and the pace of workflow is well known and the assignments are always the same and the syllabus doesn't vary from year to year, not necessarily the best condition for a teacher, but surely a frequent one. Even for the teacher, that process of midterm consolidation is important. It allows you to understand what your identity is in the course a little better and to decide what kind of teacher you have been and what kind you aspire to be in the remainder of the term. For the student, going through the thing once and only once under most circumstances, it's all the more true. And in law school, where the middle of the second semester is really a moment to begin to understand not what kind of student you mean to be in the course, but what kind of law student you mean to be in law school, and maybe with some understanding of what kind of lawyer you might want to be in the world, this is a particularly crucial time. The mid-semester break in the second semester of law school is for the identity building, psychodynamic, maybe even the professionally most significant part of law school, the most important time. But that's not your experience. This time, just once, in a fashion which is the clearest possible example, save the draft and war, of the way that history can come and sweep your life up and alter it in unison, this year it's not like that. Last week we were talking about the importance of dissociation and the nature both in the individual psyche and in the social coordination of minds, of the process of dissociating in the midst of the real in order to allow the mind to cope with reality out of control and outside the barriers with which the then dominant personality state can deal. We were thinking about this with respect to the preparation declaration messaging that overcame American society as the coronavirus appeared. A form I was suggesting in our last conversation, a form which is one through which social communities cycle as they face a certain kind of stress. A cycle which can be seen in Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's famous stages in the process of dying, beginning with the dying person's denial of the condition. A pervasive, species-wide phenomenon, as I was saying last time, that Ernst Becker pointed to in his 1974 classic, The Denial of Death, a process which isn't like Kubler-Ross's individual state construction around the process of dying, but which is a uniform species-wide effort as a conscious bunch of animals aware painfully of the inevitability of their own death and the biological fragility of their existence, the hovering possibility of instant annihilation, which has to be dissociated in order to be survived. That is, that ordinary human life depends upon the successful ability to dissociate, but which can also be seen at the social life, at the social psychological level, in a lawyer's theory of social action as a departure point for forms of social state under stress that begin with dissociative behavior designed to leave the community room in which to take on the inevitable and the destructive at its own pace. That was the process of the university over the last 2 weeks before we were suddenly snapped into a new state last Sunday, which consisted of the state of nervous system transformation in which we try to perform higher education without seeing one another. You could think then of the process of declaring at meetings how prepared we were and how ready we would be, followed by the instantaneous adoption of an entirely new social structure for which no overt preparation had been made. This process of dissociating the inevitable, followed by the adoption swiftly of a new condition, might be characterized as an example of isomorphism at the upper edge of Putnam's analysis. Putnam wants us to understand an isomorphism which runs from brain states to personality states across a range of different biological and psychic phenomena, and which are organized in increasing complexity of description, but in which, from the beginning of the neurological construction of the human mind inside the brain to the largest questions of the public presentation of emotion states and behavior states and identity states, the whole of which we come to think of as personality states, this structure of Putnam's, which carries us from one chapter to another as he works at the different layers of his isomorphism, could, for the purpose of a lawyer's theory of social action, then be raised another level isomorphically into a discussion of the states in which the influence of minds on minds places minds. At that level, then, what we have just lived through since the last time I saw you, that was a process of movement in not personality states, but social states, from the dissociation that was necessary for people to begin to understand that the life of the university would be completely disrupted by the virus, to the state of having declared control over complete disruption through the adoption of a handy technological solution, regardless of its actual educational value. This movement from states, with an abrupt switch between Sunday the 8th of March and Monday the 9th, is a good example then of the phenomenon that Putnam is calling attention to across six layers of the human mind and brain, into the social mind and the neurological structures of the university, which from a lawyer's point of view could then be carried on into another set of inquiries, economic and philosophical and anthropological, etc. So the purpose of today's virtual class is to consider, both within Putnam's structures and beyond at the level of generalization, how our own experience as citizens, students, lawyers, members of the university community can be used to generate ideas which represent, in the broader sense, a lawyer's theory of social action. As I tried to indicate in my introductory essay on virtual instruction, this also touches on the third part of our course, not just how to be creative in law school and how to use creativity in law school with a broad creative theory of social action for lawyers to imagine and then carry out the development of your law practice, but also how some technologies can be used to enable that process of creation better. As I've said, that gap, the break in the second semester of law school, is usually an extraordinarily formative time of consolidation. Maybe not quite like folding the grades into a paper airplane and flying them off a rock at Cape Cod, but then the paper chase is no better than 1L at describing how it is that we really do go through law school. And law school, of course, is utterly lousy in describing most of the time how we do go through law school. But how we go through law school, the way we are in law school, puts great value on that moment of consolidative understanding in this spring break of the second term, but you don't get that. You get something else. The something else that you get now that comes from the virtualization of the rest of the second semester courses is something I would wish to know enough about to tell you. I spend an amount of time in this course based upon what, having gone through law school myself and having spent a third of a century teaching in law school, can help me to understand about what it's like to go through law school. But I can't help here any more than you can, because all of us are experiencing something for the first and, I hope, only time. I've never seen law school disrupted in this particular way, though I've thought about how to teach under conditions of disruption. But the work I did 7.5 years ago after Hurricane Sandy, or during and after Hurricane Sandy, to figure out how to teach under conditions of disruption, in order to figure out how to make learning happen, not just virtual classes happen, that work was largely speculative. The hurricane was a storm. It came and went, and after global air travel stabilized, we all came back and went to teaching as we had done before. A gap developed in which certain states changes happened, both to the teacher caught away and wondering how to keep his course afloat, and students in all the different conditions of chaos and difficult and struggle that they had during the storm and afterwards, but we didn't have to undertake an open trajectory of change. We followed a little parabolic course and smacked on back to Earth once the airplanes landed and we all came back together again. President Bollinger's admission this morning that we will not ever resume face-to-face instruction this semester, which we spoke about ourselves last week, as you recall, and to which I then ascribed a 95% probability, which I believe explains why it wasn't hard to predict. But President Bollinger's assertion this morning that we will not ever come together again as a class means that we're on a pathway that requires us to bring our different states to an extreme. I've never tried to maintain learning for half a semester in this form, and while I projected some technology that might help to do it, I have no idea whether it will work well for you. For you are the only informants who exist, who will exist, who are existing, who are making yourselves now into whatever combination of states it is that will come out of being a second semester student at a time like this. Knowing that some of that will occur through one form of technology, the Zoomification of education, which I actually believe is the sort of just the panic state of the university trying to reorder its nervous system. I think it is not mindful. How could it be? It was all invented within a very short period of time. While that dissociative, how well we are, have already prepared stuff was going on. And really what it said is we can simulate a classroom through the internet with video conferencing. Most of the people who made that decision, I believe, were A, not teachers, and B, not very long-troubled users of video conferencing, or they might have doubted the capacity of the medium to sustain the message. Might have doubted, but would have had to go ahead anyway, because like our own effort to adapt our personality states to the world around us, they have no other place to go. They can forget, we can just take our eye off the ball, we can coast through the spring vacation, let us say, which you could think of as a kind of, you know, switching gap between states in which we don't make active memory of what we did with ourselves. A process I'm actually deliberately encouraging by not putting the student journal portion of my online course into place until after the vacation. You don't need to keep a journal in the vacation. The journal is crucial to the learning process, I believe, which is why Zoomification, which doesn't give you a place to reflect upon your own learning process, is suboptimal at a time like this. But you don't need to keep a journal during vacation. Even now, even despite the fact that everything that's about to happen is new and scary and accompanied by the possibilities of illness and harm to people you care about, and we are indeed a society vibrating with anxiety, even now, still what is most important in the break is to consolidate personality, understanding relationship to law school at the moment when you're about to go through the end of the first year and decide whether to return. But in that process, the technology. That is to say, now your nervous system is attached not to other human beings through being together, being in the room together, understanding what we're doing. Rather, the nervous system is attached only to something, that ring of power that you were carrying around all that time, and that now it's the portal to the world. And it necks through everything onto the screen by way of the data mining done by Zoom alongside the teleconferencing, and reports how you come and go, and you're under more surveillance even than you were in the classroom. But no longer is there the discipline of eye contact and the recognition that we have to maintain our personalities in the classroom, be whatever it is we are, the helium hand or the laid-back kid or the silent watcher. All of those identities have now been resolved down to the one we call user. And in the process, new state-dependent learning and memory is being created, a different way of going to law school than there used to be before. And I know more about that than you, and you are the only people who will ever be able to speak about it, which is why speaking about it, journaling, explaining what it's like to learn under these conditions and how you're relating not only to my particular course, but all the rest of what is going on is so deeply important. It produces the data that allows us, not me only or the law school, God knows, I don't even think the law school will try and understand it, will try and get over the experience and move on, reassert the stability of its identity and keep being the law school that it was. It will congratulate itself, it will pat itself on the back for not having had to give you a refund and declare itself unable to help you become lawyery under these circumstances, but it will, generally speaking, assume that whatever it is perfect and it has done it right, and the next time we'll just Zoomify ourselves again and everything will be fine. But if we really wanted to know, if we cared to understand, if we were, as William James is always to Frank Putnam, an example of the importance of the desire to know oneself, to do that work scientifically and literarily and completely, interpretively, but also quantitatively, if we were really determined to understand, then you are the voyagers we need to talk to. And by we, I mean ourselves, because it's how we use these technologies to communicate among ourselves by being separate, which determines how well and how deeply and in what qualitative way we learn. And then, of course, that means that as lawyers, we are learning about what happens in society under different circumstances. If we were wondering why biology is put at the bottom of the lawyer's theory of social action, why it is that it was so insistent that the physical animality of human beings cannot be eliminated in order to understand social action from a lawyer's point of view, surely that demonstration no longer needs to be made. I submit it before you. The virus is what biology is, right? the fragility of our lung tissue, the ease of permeation at the nostrils and the eyes, the meaning of what it takes for the kidneys to do the work of pumping every poison and problem through without collapsing under the toxicity it by design handles. All of that is now somehow immediately at the forefront of social life, such that even the greatest and most obtuse narcissist on earth, let us call him for the moment the President of the United States, is unable ultimately to ignore it. It can be dissociated, but it cannot be eliminated. And dissociation of the realities of social life is what, as lawyers, we ought not to do. Why we are spooky. Because we handle the hard matter. Because when things actually occur that cannot be ignored, like arrests, or bankruptcies, or firings, or harassment of workers, because when the animal dirt of life takes social form, we're there. Never far from evil, to coin a phrase. And that foreignness, of course, is the dissociative distance. Kafka is saying, after all, that we're lawyers, we can't just dissociate. Somebody has to do the work. Somebody has to write it down. Somebody has to read the documents and understand them. Somebody has to go to court and say, this man was one of the greats of our society, but 23 years in jail is what he now deserves. In other words, we are not in this process able most of the time to ignore the animality of human life, or at any rate, we can do it only less than others, but that means we have to be self-conscious about it. And the virus, well, that helps to teach us, because what we see around us is human beings responding to the invisible threat that is disease. With imagination, because they cannot believe what they see, because they cannot see what it is. And here it is apparent that the government of the United States dissociated in crucial moments for weeks on end, as it recognized that it had an invisible threat to cope with, but couldn't bear to open its eyes and do the testing. Or could have borne, but botched up, or politically didn't want, or, well, obviously, the scientists and doctors, the epidemiologists and physicians of the society, like us, are trained. They are, after all, never far from disease. And so in their way, too, the reality of the animal condition of the human race is always present in a way that others will prefer to hide from themselves. So they know that it wasn't their refusal to look that kept us from testing. They understand that they would have done what was done in Singapore or done in Hong Kong or done in rich, dense places where the moment that you know it's there but you can't see it, you begin to try and illuminate it. All the contact tracing, all the testing, all the effort to discover the contours of the hidden threat with science, human beings trying to avoid having to imagine by actually looking at what they can believe. But in that process, like the lawyers, they are required to cross barriers of taboo against looking, against frightening the horses, against crashing the stock market. It's a peculiarity of the lawyers' recognition of what social life is like that the biological is often the most controversial, precisely because it is the most basic, the most fundamental, the most difficult to alter. And also, as is apparent at the present moment, the most remorseless. So here we are observing in a way that maybe at another time it would be harder to do, the biological fundamentals of any theory of social action, having to do with the ways in which we are as animals vulnerable or strong, as social animals capable of cooperation and subject to atomization, as entities in the world better able to deal with the threats that they can see than with the microparasitisms which render them acutely vulnerable, but which they cannot use their eyes to understand. And we are also, at this moment, very fortunately, if one can be said to be fortunate at such a moment, thinking about the next layer above, that is the intrapsychic structures of the human mind and how, in this sense, they are related to our biological existence. Putnam's gratitude and awe at the baby watchers is shared by every sophisticated psychologist, psychiatrist, and psychoanalyst I know. This is among the most important observational science of the last generation, and it has transformed in ways that you can see the ability of those who wish to understand human nature to understand its historical individual roots. But what Putnam is saying about the baby watchers and the extraordinary power of their efforts is for him the entrance to this isomorphism of state as the organizing concept of psychology from the edge of anatomy to the edge of society. Across the whole of the range, from the nature of how the physiology of the brain organizes the mind, to the structures of sleep and waking, the rhythms of our biological diurnal existence, the organizations of our senses into cognitive structures, the roles of the behavioral states that we inherit down the line of existence through all the chordates and beyond, the ways in which our structures of understanding experience may be 300 million years distant from those of the octopus, and yet at the same time reflective of the processes of organization of cognition, of sensory data into cognitive states, followed by planning and execution of complex behavior in a difficult and changing physical environment, that life evolves these structures of state and behavior in the throughout the biosphere. This is what links us to everything else and also differentiates us as human beings from the other cousins, the ones from whom we parted only a few million years ago, not because any of those elements of the psychology of state are fundamentally different between us and our cousins, the chimps or the bonobo, but rather because we, with all of the subsequent complexity of language and the re-representation of experience, have evolved new layers atop that isomorphism. We don't merely experience states of behavior and states of emotion. Not only do we possess states of identity, but we see them complexly. We in our identities, we are already devising symbolic, linguistic, interpretive representations of what it means to be a mother or a son or a sister or a lover or a teacher or a killer. So in that sense, even as we occupy all the terrain we can see emerges from the biology into the minds of animal life, we are also at the edges taking those same fundamental conditions, the repetition of normal states in ordinary rotation, morning, noon, night, sleeping, waking, eating, mating, all of that behavioral repertoire associated with particular states rising from the brain into the consciousness that we can see around us is biologically earth-like. happens in our dogs and cats, occurs in the birds and the trees, is there in the dinosaurs from which those birds evolved, all of that, and yet complexified at the edge of psychic life, of the psychic life of the birds or the dogs or the chimps or the trees, comparatively created in a new form as a result of the rich symbolic context in which human language and human culture envelops all of it. And every state, therefore, has names in our languages and can be described, indeed has to be described, in our syntax. And the condition of our thinking about the universe at all is that it can be thought about logically, that it can be reduced to sequences of causes and effects that we can see with our mind's eye, that we can believe through our science, and which therefore transforms everything underneath it. But here, at any rate, is Putnam's point. The isomorphism that runs from the states of the brain to the states of behavior to the states of emotion to the states of identity, along pathways which are at one and the same time repetitive and flexible, which allow us to go from one state to another, whether we are now talking about a behavior state, from eating to mating, or the emotional state, from love to war, or at the level of identity, from being a son to being a father, all through processes which we can expect in the ordinary life to cycle repetitively. We are this and then we're that, because it's morning and then it's noon, because it's work and then it's play, because it's food and then it's sex. But all of this, to the extent that we ordinarily repeat it, and often repetition is an important aspect of how the state is related to the states around it, we are flexible. And the pathways are multiple, and they are reversible, and there's almost no structure in anything higher in the order of our culture than our sleep, in which it can be said that the routine is predictable and that the processes march in series. I was much less aware of the sequence of my sleep states when I was young. Now, as an old man who has to get up to urinate several times a night, I know the timing of my states far more effectively than I used to. The long first cycle, the short periods of REM at the end before I wake up and I discover that my bladder calls me, or that period in which I am still movement inhibited from the depths of sleep, and I am merely lying there knowing that soon I will get up and go to the bathroom, but not yet capable of moving my mind. All of that, pathetically now, as an old man, I can see more clearly than when I was a youth, but it was there. I know it was there. I have little bits of memory linked to my identity as a person asleep that I can think of back through my life and reaccess those cycles, even if I was at the time sleeping through them, if you like. And in this way, the repetitiveness of my life from home to class to home to out to in, that these things too, and mine is a far less regimented life than most people's, because I live it alone and can do what I want in the complex cycle synchronization that is most family life. The state alternation is even more likely to be stable, because the needs of the children and the spouse and the are all likely to occur in some process disciplined in time. But we recognize that every single one of those things can be disrupted by a sudden need for change, circumstances outside, illness, for example, or the accidents of physics. And suddenly we are adapting, not necessarily by creating a new state. Indeed, that's usually the sign of something quite drastic and probably unpleasant, but by reaching for another part of the existing structure. In Putnam's chapter 6 example of the hypothetical subject Jim, who gets angry in his ordinary life, disrupting his cycle of ordinary relationships, goes through a cool down process, a state specific to the getting rid of anger condition, which the anger itself summons, and which the psychological causes of the anger thereby summon, but returns from cool down into whichever portion of the ordinary cycle of identity states is common in his life, performing the behaviors and feeling the feelings natural to the time and place, but who as an artist sometimes then generates or a pathway into other states, which in that example were referred to as creativity one, the ordinary work of doing art, and creativity two, the higher level experience that Jim has of sometimes having his art come full blown in touch with the deeper and greater realities of the world, all of which exists orthogonally to the ordinary cycles of daily life and the occasional outbursts of anger and cooling off and withdrawing and coming back, which are a repertoire, a palette, we might say, in not just Jim's case, of the colors in which our mind paints us in the world. And which are both purely mundane and utterly repetitious, and at the same time capable of generating masterpieces that only a human being could have made and only some human beings ever do. This Jim, this ideal of a human being, then can be used to, as a jumping off point for our own ideas about the people that we are, that we know, that we sometimes feel like, that we sort of resemble, or that we simply live with because we love and need them and we're a little afraid to understand. We are, after all, generally speaking, emotionally dependent upon the idea that we aren't a collection of states, a chorus of alternates, that we're neither dissociative identity disorder patients nor anything like that at all, that we are solid through and through, like a potato, the same way that children have a tendency to imagine their own animal reality, the diversity, complexity, and messiness of all that stuff inside is unapparent to a child younger than five, who generally just thinks it's a solid self. And we, even after we have learned a little bit more about the biological realities of our sadness, we still tend to think that of our psyche. And therefore, we say to the people we love, the children we raise, the lovers we inhabit with, we say to them, but that's not you. At all levels, at all times, we say it when a child is fractious and refuses to behave. We say it when a brother or a parent does something fundamentally incongruous to our understanding, or at least our expectations, or perhaps our wishes of them. And we say it in the most heated moments of intimate combat. That's not you. And yet what we really mean, of course, is that part of you, that state of you, that self-state that is presently or was then behaving, acting, doing, expressing, is one that we don't wish to acknowledge, and so we say categorically, that isn't you. There's a you, and that's not it. And again, as Putnam points out, this is the gravest of problems to account for in the ways that we live secret lives. And we account for it largely by denying or punishing the idea of the separateness of ourselves. And so we say that it's hypocrisy or criminality or betrayal, or we use terms of judgment which are inherently derisive in order to express an idealized view of human personality which is, in addition to everything else, wrong. So we find ourselves trying to fit everything into a pattern and throwing away or denying or exiling or just plain attempting to annihilate the things that do not fit. Our theory of our unitary personality is the bed of Procrustes, and we do just lop off, using amnesia, using interpersonal violence, using persuasion, using reinforcement. We lop off those pieces which do not fit the logical or at least unitary theory of personality we have adopted. And where that won't suffice, we do what is known in the trade these days as othering. That is to say, we attribute the inconsistency to the inferiority of some group or other. This, more than anything else, is the vocabulary of misogyny, for example. Women are inconsistent. Women are changeable. Women are fickle. Women are this. Women are not that. Women are... The grammar of misogyny is composed of the need to simplify, not to say dismember, female persons, subjecting them to what is sometimes thought of as the male gaze or the ideology of patriarchy, but which at another level can be thought of as the othering of complexity. This, then, the process by which we try and figure out how to treat one another as simple, to have an abbreviation for the nature of the human being, which allows for "that's not you," "he wasn't like that," "how could he possibly," "what did she think," all of that, which in her own immense sagacity, my 34-year-old mother was trying to tell her 11-year-old son, "you shouldn't do," when she pen the sentence, "you must always remember the multiplicity of personality." That need to avoid the complex and the interpretively difficult, which my mother had very little of as a feminist theorist, as a literary critic, as a teacher, or as a mother, that desire to avoid the complexity of interpretation and preference to the simplicity of rule might be thought of in a way as a lawyer's reflex. We ought to be the people most determined to simplify the human personality. We are, of course, the wielders of rules and the imposers of judgments. We are the punishers of hypocrites and the judgment seat before which criminals appear, and we are the ones who detect inconsistency in the documents and straighten things out. But truly, the lawyer's theory of action is never that of the simple, always that of the complex. So when we recognize the way in which a human being's life in society adds to the states of behavior and emotion, the states of identity, what we can now call at the top of the isomorphic tower that Putnam is constructing, personality states. That is, public presentations in society, at the social layer of the body, personality states that are arrangements of all that comes below, that join the conditions of personality, of identity, and the pathways between them, that explain in some orchestration the movements among behavior states and emotions, that are the higher order forms of, let us say, as Putnam says of one patient, that they are hurt but working on the one hand and tra-la-la on the other. These forms that represent high-level profiles of our presentation of self, that these also in the human being are multiple, that they come and go, that they are finite and that they are recognizable, and that they vary from one to another across pathways through switches which are both repetitive and also flexible. That this form of thinking about a human being as a three-dimensional map of personality states themselves acting as configurations of emotion and behavior, that all of this is in relation to a series of identities, social, personal, familial, and that the personalities organize those structures in overarching ways. This then begins to come to fruition as the psychology of a lawyer's theory of social action. To us, whether it's the client or the decision maker or the partner for whom we work, the process of mapping that set of personality states, how they come and go, what the pathways are, how they switch, the substitution of a complex and interpretive approach to each of those human beings who influence the circumstances of our lives, affect our clients' welfare, represent, as Holmes would put it, the incidence of the public force. How we conceptualize those human beings is at the center of everything else we do. When we're interviewing a client, we are looking not for one, but for multiple forms of personality state. And as time goes by, as we meet a human client or the human representative of a corporate client, in every setting, at every time, we're watching for those changes of state and personality. We're looking for an understanding of the configuration, not to determine what is them or not them, not to put each person in a pigeonhole or to endow them with a personality, but rather to try at every moment to be adding to our understanding of what the complex of components, the instruments in the orchestra of this human being are. Here again, Putnam's effort to explain how to think about the relationship between dissociative identity disorder, that is multiple personality, in a case where the patient has personalities with distinct names and life patterns which can be summoned more or less directly, interactively through asking for them, and that of the ordinary, run-of-the-mill standard human being who might be in psychotherapy is extremely valuable. We're not psychotherapists, we're lawyers. Our effort is not mostly to change the client, but to make the world conform in one way or another to the client's needs, or at least to prevent it from destroying the client's interests. But in the same way that the pathways of dissociative identity disorder help to explain how to look at the patient in therapy, to allow for forms of configuration analysis, for example. It's also true with respect to the client, whether it is the Serbian Fujinese kid or Harvey Weinstein or IBM. The effort to understand not a single monolith of behavior and feeling, but rather the complex set of interlocking states will always help. We are, after all, whatever the kind of interview it is, whatever the interaction with the client is, whether it's the first or the last, we're always trying to grasp more thoroughly the understanding of what it is that the client wants and needs, and to allocate in that very uncertain and vulnerable way, the shifting ethical line between allowing the client to make a decision and influencing the decision the client is allowed to make. In all of those places, we are, after all, trying to see who we are dealing with. And whether that's a question about whether to plead guilty to a frightened teenage defendant, or whether it's a question of trying to understand whether the Getty trustees did or did not make a contract with the Pennzoil Corporation, our understanding of the shifting personality conditions prevailing within the parties is of enormous importance. And this is true, again, as I say, not merely with respect to the personal interactions, which are the center of the representation of a client by a lawyer, but also the forms that govern how one deals with the judges before whom one appears, and the partners for whom one works, and the adversaries of whom one is trying to take advantage. And in each of these and all the other contexts, we're fishing for the states of personality and how we can realize our own in relation to them. Because, of course, for us, it's always a two-body problem. For the relational psychotherapist, too, there's not much point in asking what is happening to the patient unless we are also asking what is happening to the analyst. And the analyst's effort to understand herself is surely the most important part of what she does, because herself is what is closest to her. Even the patient exists across a social distance, maybe less than our current social distancing. There's an awful lot of psychotherapy that soon will be happening in the United States by phone, which may or may not work very well that way. It never did for me, I have to say. And at any rate, we are always thinking at a minimum about the client first and ourselves second. Even if all we are doing is drawing a will or a healthcare proxy or some other document primarily of interest only, or at least only the client's business. Still, we are also implicitly at that moment thinking two more thoughts, one about what we might be called upon to do with respect to this thing we are creating, how we would testify about it, how we would document it, what the files are that need to be retained concerning it, etc., but also what its effect will be on third parties, whoever those may be. The heirs or those not inheriting, the doctors or administrators who must see this proxy and behave accordingly with respect to the client, now a patient, etc., etc. In other words, for us always, the question is how the thing we are doing addresses not only the client's personality states, but our own, and conceivably, almost always, somewhere, those of third parties with whom we are working, or against whom we are working, or against the background of whom we are working. This arrangement of our understanding, what we can now fully refer to, we have earned the phrase, our lawyer's theory of social action, begins then by understanding that each of us in our multiple personality states interacts with the multiple personality states of others. Like the DID patient whose personality goes from a female part with a soft southern accent to a male part who identifies as partly Native American and who is the protector of the body and the preventer of internal self-destructive conflict, whom a waiter could perceive one moment as a woman and then believe to be a completely different person. Do you need a menu, sir, at the next trip to the table? Like that waiter, we are aware, like the DID patient, of the movement of personality states around us, and we interact with them. But one of the underlying rules of social psychology in a world of multiple personality is that we also act to conceal multiplicity, both from others and from ourselves. With respect to others, we mostly do not find ourselves like that waiter, boldly calling attention to the transitions of personality. Mostly, we try to treat people as though they were unitary, much as we try to think about them as though they were unitary. It is a taboo to call too much attention to a personality state change. As I have mentioned in the classroom last week, in those face-to-face interactions which we used to have while we did this course together, I sometimes deliberately violated that taboo, called attention to a personality state change as posture changed in a chair and facial expression came and went, and as the process of communicating caused me not merely to map out internally for myself, but to mirror externally back the conclusions or observations that I came to in the course of the talk. We don't do that. That's not what we're supposed to do. That's spooky. So in our interactions with others, we mostly help to paper over for them the changes that they go through. And we ourselves, of course, inhibit our awareness of those changes via the kind of hypnotic gaps that Putnam shows us, in which it becomes very hard for us even to remember that there was a moment when we changed, let alone what it felt like to go through the change. I would suggest that those who are either professionally or personally interested in the subject read Putnam's chapter 7 on substance abuse. The relationship between human beings and the drugs upon which they are dependent, that is, the molecules upon which they are dependent, that is not necessarily just the sugar, the salt, and the caffeine, but somewhat more complex molecules with different blood-brain barrier characteristics. The presence of those drugs and our relationships to them is so much about the part of our brain physiology and psychic construction in the switches. The faster that a drug begins to cause a personality transition and a set of associated brain states, behavior patterns, etc., as Putnam points out, the more likely it is to become addictive. That is, the more likely we are to become regular users of the molecule in order to facilitate the voyages between states that they create, where the drug is slower at the facilitation of state switches, the more likely we are not to think of it as addictive, not to treat it as addictive, not to behave addictedly, the more we are inclined to think of it as a molecule upon which we are at most, quote, psychologically dependent. And this has all sorts of consequences for the way we think about such ideas as internet addiction or sex addiction, etc. The point here for the moment, however, is that those switches, the processes by which they are mediated, are either internal or they are social. They are cued either from the processes, psychological or physiological, within the body, the ingestion of a molecule, the coming or going of light and dark, the complex orchestration of the internal rhythms of the flow of time, or they are related to what occurs external. Putnam on panic attacks is useful, both for those of us who do and for those of us who don't suffer them. The rapid transition to a state of high anxiety, which is triggered either internally, maybe by something as simple as a small molecule, sodium lactate, or whether it is the result of an interaction with an abusive superior, those structures which cause the sudden transition to a state of high anxiety require a state of high anxiety to exist. That is to say, as Putnam points out, you can't induce a panic attack in those who don't suffer life with at least one state of high and intense anxiety. But if there is a destination there to be found, you can punch a pathway to it either by a form of social summoning or by a form of internal physiological realignment. Breathing high carbon dioxide off the top of a soda bottle isn't going to bring about a panic attack in those of us who don't have high anxiety, but it's remarkably capable of doing so with those who contain at least one panicked state. Now in that process, we begin to understand how, from a theory of the way we are, this is also a theory of the way we are together. That is to say that when we observe social interactions, aware of the multiplicity of the personality states within each individual, we also then become aware of the ways in which the surrounding social drama is eliciting those states, bringing out one, causing a switch in another, and that the human beings involved in that process are cueing one another's transitions without being directly aware of them. This is the way in which we find ourselves fully aware of human social life as that comedy of errors. The pieces, each with multiple facets, facing one another randomly and causing them to switch in ways that they may not fully understand. What it is like to be in a professional partnership, what it is like to be in a marriage, what it is like to be raising a child, what it is like to deal with a parent, is always that process, because the relationships themselves are long and intense and they are repetitive at the same time that they are recurrently stressful. What it is like in such a relationship is to experience all the various combinations of state, all the different ways in which we relate each to one another's eachness. But even a little bit of self-awareness, even a little bit of ability to see and reflect upon those changes as they are occurring, both internally and externally, conveys enormous leverage in social life. Naturally, we tend to think of this as about hypocrisy and flattery. That is to say, we are again talking about it as though there were real parts of a human being and less real parts of a human being. But in fact, the dynamics of relationship in these ways are also very complicated. And the two-party play in which the parties move through all their different personality structures in sequence, like, I don't know, Athel Fugard's The Blood Knot, or all the dramas of Eugene O'Neill, which are essentially about those structures mediated by drink and undertaken in the company of others. The small group structures, which are as distinctive in a way as Left's two and three-party playlets in the understanding of swindling and selling, all of those pieces of literature and art which allow us to incorporate our sense of those random interfaces, those collections of the different facets facing different ways, are guides to what it means to think creatively about the social life we see around us, whether it's in a family or in a courtroom. So here then, we see how Putnam's ideas can take us not just from the biological layer of our theory of social action through the intrapsychic psychology layer of that theory of social action which we are building, but crucially to the layer of most immediate concern to us, the building blocks of social psychological life, the influence of minds on minds, and the way that that influence of minds on minds is reflected in the layers above, of the ordering of social institutions, the creation and interpretation of cultures, and ultimately, of course, to the reasoning about rules and standards and processes and structures of decision-making and dispute-having, which are the business of the lawyers tout court. So much for half a term. In my judgment, the right place to be at this moment. The next best place to be in this moment, I think, given everything going on around us, is a lifeboat in the South Atlantic containing, well, four men and, I don't know, 24 or 30 personality states, faced with a problem of survival. Loose and on their own, except, of course, that we never are. I assume that for Bernard, Regina against Dudley and Stevens is a useful case in the criminal law, and I hope that after a vacation cheerfully spent in the midst of the epidemic, considering survival cannibalism and murder at sea, that you will feel also that it was a happy and productive experience. At any rate, I will assign A.W.B. Brian Simpson's Cannibalism and the Common Law as reading for the break, and we'll talk about it in relation to some lawyers we know when we are all not together again on the Tuesday following. I wish you a good and safe and healthy time. Please do keep notified of changes in the wiki. That is now our only primary means of communication. There will be things happening there, and I will be reading and editing and returning the first drafts of your first essays during the course of the break. Our time may be less regimented, but I hope it will be every bit as creative, and I hope that we will find our way to turn these next weeks into a good, though different, way of being in law school without being there. There will be online office hours. Those will be posted on the website front page, and they will be hosted on an Ethernet that is a shared web pad where we can write and chat and do all the things we do except looking at or hearing one another. There will be instructions about how to begin journaling your experience of the virtual course. It's still vacation, however, with the reading in it, and I don't expect you to do any significant work until we all get so-called back. Take the time, think things through, discover who you are. That's way more important than even the virus, let alone law school. Talk to you later.